vast swaths of America without ever seeing or experiencing anything. This notion wasn't lost on state officials in the early 1960s, but they realized that there was one place where they could still make a favorable impression on the growing number of travelers passing inside their borders, the rest areas they built and controlled. As a result, the stop-offs that had previously been treated as mere public facilities were promoted to a far more important role in public relations. They became state ambassadors. The elevated status of rest areas was often reflected in their aesthetic design. Rest area architects increasingly viewed the project as important venues for showcasing a region's rich culture, history, and vision for the future. The designs they created often distilled building styles common in the area, using noteworthy local building materials, signature types of stone in the Midwest and Northeast, heavy timber in the Northwest, adobe in the Southwest, and so on. Artistic tile mosaics on interior walls became a popular way of sharing the traditions, activities, and themes unique to each area. Outside, commemorative plaques and kiosks often told the stories of significant historical events that had taken place nearby. Planners didn't always look to the past for inspiration. Sometimes they chose to cultivate more progressive perceptions of their state by borrowing from popular modern architectural trends. In the mid-1960s, these included low horizontal structures with flat or butterfly roofs, decorative screen block entrances, and open interior spaces with severe geometric lines. During the 1970s, modernist trends veered toward rectangular buildings with tall, vertically sloped, low-hanging shingled roofs. Rest areas also became important places for large-scale pieces of public art. In some cases, the buildings themselves became works of art. Some of the most noteworthy examples are scattered across America's Southwest, where rest area designers transformed simple picnic shelters into giant teepees, oil derricks, stylized longhorn cattle, rockets, and other symbols of local industries and heritage. In performing their function as state ambassadors, rest areas assumed another role as well as the years passed, that of cultural custodians, capturing and safeguarding the past, present, and even future aspirations of a region and its people at a particular moment in time. In doing so, many of the classic rest areas have become all the more fascinating to stop off and see today. However, you might want to make those visits soon. Unfortunately, like many other fixtures of the heydays of the highways, the original rest areas are disappearing quickly. As our interstate highways have become more built up and technology has advanced, the need for rest areas today just isn't what it used to be. With another McDonald's or Wendy's waiting just a few miles down the road, few travelers pack picnic lunches anymore. Smartphones have dispensed with the need to stop to ask for directions. Safer and far more reliable vehicles mean breakdowns are far less common. And if anyone has to use the restroom, well, if they can hold it until the next exit, there will be a Starbucks where they can also grab coffee. Of course, rest areas will always have some place along our highways, especially along remote stretches. At state borders, large and modern welcome centers will also likely forever await visitors to dispense information on local attractions and offer helpful guidance. But as state budgets grow ever tighter and aging rest area facilities become more costly to maintain, it's not hard to guess what will become of the classic SRAs from America's golden years of road travel. And as we move on down the road, it's only natural to feel a little wistful for the things we leave behind. As for now, let's keep moving. State authorities weren't the only ones trying to promote their interests to passing tourists. Plenty of local officials and private businesses tried to capture travelers' attention and lighten their wallets as well. One could write an entire book about America's most notable and curious roadside attractions. In fact, many people have. But in the interest of making time, we'll just pull over to cover a few of the best attractions. One of the earliest and most beloved is the famous Mystery Spot located near Santa Cruz, California. According to legend, in 1939, a handyman named George Prather went out for a walk in some woods near Highway 17 one afternoon, when he began to feel slightly dizzy. Checking his compass, Prather watched dumbfounded as the arrow inexplicably spun around. He soon discovered other anomalies in the area. Prather was fascinated, and thought others would be as well. He purchased a 3-acre parcel of the land, then built a shack on the side of what came to be known as a gravity hill. For a small fee, Prather led visitors out to the shack, where balls appeared to roll uphill, and guests could lean far out over their feet without falling over, seemingly defying the laws of physics. After being featured in a 1948 issue of Life magazine and later on the television show You Asked for It, the mystery spot began to draw hordes of fascinated tourists from around the world. Years later, the mind-boggling phenomena were attributed to Prather's own cockeyed perspective. He'd simply built a tilted house. The structure's imperceptible slant and lack of a visible horizon throw off visitors' ability to correctly perceive what is truly level. Yet the mystery spot's intriguing illusions continue to amaze visitors, and it remains open to this day. Well south of the mystery spot, travelers since 1969 have been tempted to discover The Thing near Texas Canyon, Arizona. The attraction is hard to miss. Motorists are confronted with, by one estimate, as many as 247 billboards touting the mysterious MacGuffin along the highways between Phoenix, Tucson, and El Paso. In the interest of keeping the secret, I won't divulge exactly what The Thing is, except to say that the exhibit was originally created by a man known for peddling faux shrunken heads, mermaids, and other biological oddities as sideshow attractions. To see a real mermaid in the flesh, motorists needed to head much farther east, to Florida. There, in tiny Weeki Wachee, a former stunt swimmer named Newt Perry established his famous mermaid shows in 1947, in hopes of netting travelers heading south to destinations like Fort Lauderdale and Miami. Those who stopped were treated to an underwater ballet performed in a natural spring pool by beautiful women dressed in fetching fishtail costumes. Elvis Presley and Esther Williams are among the many luminaries who attended a performance. You can too. Even today, the shows remain an immensely popular attraction. It didn't take anything as exotic as sultry, slippery sirens to lure travelers headed west along desolate I-90 to Mount Rushmore. All it took was the promise of free ice water. With few other places for motorists to stop, the offer, now posted on billboards for hundreds of miles in both directions, was sufficient to turn Ted Husted's humble small-town drugstore into a bustling cowboy-themed mega-mall. Since Husted's wife Dorothy first conceived the free water promotion in 1941, Wall Drug has evolved into what is likely the nation's most famous roadside attraction, drawing 2 million thirsty visitors to a remote South Dakota town each year. Perhaps nowhere else in America did businesses work harder, or show more creativity, in enticing motorists to pull over than along the famous Route 66, stretching from Chicago to the West Coast. Traffic along the highway was often seasonal and sporadic. To survive, businesses that lined the route had to try every means possible to get motorists to stop and spend their money. The most obvious of these tactics were the colossal fiberglass people attractors. Giant hot dogs, guns, pies, cowheads, ice cream cones, and other items associated with the goods each proprietor was hawking. Before long, the buildings themselves took on attention-getting shapes. Restaurants morphed into gigantic shoes, sombreros, and UFOs. Diners were served in retired trolley cars, cabooses, and airplanes. Motels assumed the appearance of log cabins, alpine cottages, and, of course, Indian-style teepees. At the Wigwam Village chain's peak, 7 of Frank Redford's unique roadside inns lined Route 66. Other oddities appeared as well. Along the highway in Catoosa, Oklahoma, motorists were amazed to come across a beached blue whale. More than 80 feet long and sporting a friendly smile, the whale sits in a small watering hole, inviting overheated travelers to take a quick dip. Interestingly, the well wasn't originally built as a tourist attraction. It was a wedding present constructed by a man named Hugh Davis for his bride Zelta, and intended for use by their family only. A little farther along Route 66 in Tulsa, road trippers ran into the Golden Driller, a towering brass-toned oil man wearing a hard hat built in 1952 to tout the area's good fortune as the oil capital of the world. A newer, even taller, and bare-chested version replaced the original in 1966. At 75 feet in height, it's one of the tallest freestanding statues in the United States. So tall, he requires an actual retired oil derrick on which to support his gloved right hand. Of course, it wasn't just the cities and businesses along Route 66 vying for the attention of motorists. Outlandish, oversized objects could be found beside highways all over America. The world's largest catsup bottle awaited tourists in Collinsville, Illinois, and the world's largest light bulb became a beacon for visitors to Edison, New Jersey, home of the inventor's Menlo Park Laboratory. Honoring its hometown's rich automotive history, the world's largest tire, 80 feet tall, can be seen near the Detroit Metro Airport. For years, there was a running duel between two parties for the title of world's largest ball of twine. The ball got rolling, winding, when a Minnesota farmer named Francis A. Johnson, the son of Senator Magnus Johnson, began tying the ends of spare bits of sisal and coiling them up in 1950. Inspired by newspaper accounts of Johnson's curious and ever-expanding creation, Frank Stober of Cawker City, Kansas set to work on his own ball in 1953. Stober wound so diligently that he eventually surpassed the size of Johnson's ball despite his later start. In 1973, Stober's ball of twine was the first to be recognized by Guinness as the world's largest, measuring in at more than 11 feet in diameter. However, Stober's death the following year gave Johnson the opportunity he needed to once again surpass his rival. After several years of furious winding, Johnson finally succeeded, as confirmed by Guinness in 1979. And Johnson wasn't done. Despite failing health, he continued adding to his enormous orb until finally reaching the end of his string on his death in 1989. Now, 12 feet in diameter and weighing 17,400 pounds, Johnson's ball was gifted to the nearby town of Darwin, Minnesota, where it is celebrated exactly as its sole creator left it, housed in a glass-enclosed gazebo in a central park. Unwilling to accept second-class status, however, authorities in Cawker City opted to turn Stober's sphere into an ongoing pursuit, setting up the ball in an open-air pavilion where tourists were encouraged to make their own contributions and help reclaim the record. Today, the Cawker City version is generally considered the biggest of its kind, at last check measuring in at more than 40 feet in circumference and more than 8 million feet of twine. Incredibly, there are two additional contenders, though their claims to the title are controversial. A ball exhibited in the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Branson, Missouri, was certified as the largest by Guinness in 1994. However, rather than traditional brown sisal twine, the Branson ball is composed of lighter weight and multicolored plastic twine, which many dismiss as a qualifier. A fourth ball, created in eccentric isolation since 1979, by a man in Lake Nebogamon, Wisconsin, is made of short strands of multicolored twine and was wound in a way that is many times denser and heavier, but significantly smaller than the Cawker City ball. It appears that the true claim to the world's largest ball of twine lies in the eye of the ball holder. Johnson's ball remains the largest wound by a single creator. The competition between the two towns certainly wasn't the only world's largest rivalry. Fittingly, there have been even bigger ones. Six parties around the country have laid claim to possessing the world's largest frying pan. Most are well over 12 feet in diameter and are used to fry eggs or chickens at local fairs. Such skillet braggadocio pales in comparison to the dozens of businesses claiming to be sitting on the world's largest chair, each padding its claim to its own advantage. While a lumber store in Binghamton, New York, boasted of building the world's largest ladderback chair, An office supply dealer in Anniston, Alabama, declared that it had created the world's largest office chair. And at least a half dozen claimants feud over the record for the world's largest rocking chair. You get the idea. Even harder to keep track of back in the road trip's golden era were all of the world's largest animals. Depending on where your journey led you, you might run into the world's largest buffalo, bull, Holstein cow, turtle, prairie dog, muskie, clam, sperm whale, loon, hippo, jackalope, or just about any other animal, real or imaginary. In tiny Enterprise, Alabama, you can still find the world's largest, and only, boll weevil monument, erected by the town after a plague of the insects destroyed surrounding cotton crops, delivering a tough lesson to local farmers on the importance of crop diversification. True story. With so many competing attractions lining America's highways, it should be no surprise that billboards touting them all started to become a real issue. By the 1960s, the saturation of billboards in some areas got so bad that it became nearly impossible for traveling motorists to see the land they'd set out to explore. Among these motorists were Lyndon B. Johnson and his wife, Claudia, known by most as Lady Bird. During the time Lyndon served as a U.S. congressman and senator, the couple often drove from their ranch in Texas to Washington, D.C. While on the road, Lady Bird frequently expressed her frustration at the number of billboards, junkyards, and other unsightly scenes spoiling the view from her window. So when Lyndon became America's 36th president, she pressed him to do something about it. President Eisenhower had made an earlier attempt to deal with the problem, offering states an extra 0.5% in federal highway funding if they controlled the spread of billboards along the interstates. But the powerful and well-funded billboard industry was largely successful in blocking the effort. Clearly, the Johnsons would have a fight on their hands. Locked in a pitched battle with the Outdoor Advertising Association of America, Johnson and his congressional allies struggled to pass the Highway Beautification Act in 1965. They succeeded, but not without making major concessions. Billboards were banned along interstates, except in those areas of commercial and industrial use, a vague phrase the billboard industry would continually exploit. What's more, where companies were required to remove their billboards, they were handsomely compensated. Still, the Highway Beautification Act, inspired by Lady Bird Johnson, did limit the growth of billboards, required junkyards and other roadside messes to be screened, and provided funds for local highway cleanup efforts. That's not to say the highways were free from junk, especially by the time my family came rolling along in the 1970s. In an era when many cars weren't yet equipped with air conditioning, motorists often drove with their windows down, making it all too convenient for occupants to simply throw used wrappers, cans, and cigarette butts into the breeze. Even worse, many people, my parents being exceptions, considered the practice acceptable. I can still vividly recall seeing the shoulders of highways cluttered with mounds of paper cups, pull tabs, and other jettisoned trash, even outside urban areas. Fortunately, those responsible for creating the mess were also among the first to work toward cleaning it up. In the 1950s, the country's leading can and bottle manufacturers joined Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Philip Morris, Anheuser-Busch, and other consumer product companies to form Keep America Beautiful, KAB, an organization promoting anti-litter efforts. The consortium's goals weren't entirely noble. Sure, KAB sought to reduce the amount of trash, but it also wanted to shift blame for the litter problem away from producers of disposable packaging to consumers, so-called litter bugs. As part of its effort, KAB was responsible for creating one of the most memorable TV commercials of all time. Debuting on Earth Day in 1971, the spot depicted a Native American rowing his canoe through a river of floating garbage. After the Indian reached shore near a busy highway, a passing motorist tossed a bag of trash out of his car's window that landed at the man's feet. As the camera dramatically closed in, a tear rolled down his cheek, as an announcer gravely intoned, "People start pollution. People can stop it." The face of the crying Indian became one of the most indelible images of the 1970s. It was also one of the most deceptive. The actor who portrayed the Indian was a full-blooded Italian, born Espera Oscar De Corti. In his 20s, De Corti contrived the false persona of Iron Eyes Cody to win Native American roles in Hollywood westerns. Being a kid, I wasn't overly concerned about the enormous amount of pollution cluttering the nation's highways. Instead, my mind was on junk of another kind, souvenirs. Knowing I would inevitably have to give some sort of speech about my trip at school, it was crucial that I bring back something remarkable to impress my classmates and help me nail down an easy A from my teacher. After all, I had a reputation to uphold. From previous presentations, my classmates knew my family traveled a lot, and I'd already hauled in an impressive array of extraordinary pieces from our earlier travels. A plastic bottle of water from the real Fountain of Youth in St. Augustine, Florida. A cool, wide-brimmed Union Cavalry hat from Gettysburg. Even a genuine voodoo doll wrapped in creepy Spanish moss from the French Quarter in New Orleans. I was also the proud owner of what I assumed was the world's most expansive collection of Moldorama figurines. Moldorama machines were freestanding, blow-molded plastic vending machines placed in zoos, museums, and other popular attractions beginning in 1962. Their allure was the magic of seeing figurines made right before your eyes. You drop a few quarters into the slot, then press your nose up against the clear plastic viewing bubble to watch two hydraulic arms push the halves of a complete mold together. Then the machine would light up and start shaking and whirring as hot liquid plastic was injected into the mold and air was blasted inside to push it into every crevice. After a moment of suspenseful silence, the arms would pull the halves of the mold apart to reveal a shiny single-color figurine that would drop down into a bin where it could be retrieved. When you pulled it out, it would still be warm and fill your nostrils with the intoxicating aroma of molten resin. Individually, the cooled figurines were nothing special, but a collection like mine was. It included an ape, lion, panther, robot, rhino, polar bear, seahorse, dolphin, T-Rex, stegosaurus, and more. I was a Moldorama mogul. I also felt pressure to keep the competition at bay. Other kids in my class traveled as well, and several had begun returning from their trips with impressive specimens of their own. One boy brought in a genuine tin deputy's badge from the real OK Corral. Another kid exhibited a fully inflated blowfish from Florida coated in a thick layer of lacquer to maintain its shape. Still another girl boosted her popularity by distributing handfuls of saltwater taffy from the boardwalk in Atlantic City. To stay on top, I would need to choose carefully, because I'd get only one shot. One pricey souvenir would likely be all I'd be able to shake down for my mom per trip. To make a solid selection, I needed to meticulously preview the itinerary for our trip and identify the stops or attractions where I'd likely find the best souvenirs. On one trip to Florida, I'd foolishly opted for a cheesy coconut shell bongo set when, if I'd waited a few days longer, I could have brought home an entire box of foil-wrapped packets of freeze-dried ice cream, the same kind eaten in space by real astronauts from the gift store at NASA's Kennedy Space Center. On those occasions when distractions like the game bag had lost their power to divert, and I wasn't preoccupied with whether we'd reach a gas station, I found other ways to pass the miles. Sometimes I'd climb up on the rear window ledge to take in the scenery, or try to coax truckers to sound their air horns by clenching my fist and gesturing up and down on an invisible pull cord. Often I'd fall asleep on the ledge and wake up to find that hours, even entire states, had passed while I snoozed. I might doze off in Indiana and wake up in Tennessee. To a kid my age, it was as amazing as teleportation or time travel. Almost as fascinating was monitoring the changes that took place as we progressed to warmer climes. During our travels over Easter break in particular, it was almost magical to observe the transition from the bluster and gray of the Midwest and its drifts of snow to the vibrant greenery and budding blossoms that were already heralding the arrival of spring just a few hours south. Aboard our land yacht, we were watching the seasons change right before our eyes, like the time-lapse nature sequences they'd sometimes show on Sesame Street. The experience of piling into a car in the morning, shivering and bundled in thick winter jackets, then stepping out into warm sunshine at a gas stop just hours later, was almost surreal. We were like bears taking our first steps outside the cave after a long winter's hibernation. As the weather changed, so did the scenery. Heading south, the rolling hills of Wisconsin gradually leveled off into the wide, flat cornfields of central Illinois. In the lower part of the state, we'd passed through vast tracts of oil pump jacks stretching as far as the eye could see. With their steelheads bobbing up and down atop long-legged stands, the pump jacks resembled enormous animals grazing in pastures. I'm told that farmhands who worked the pump jacks commonly referred to them as thirsty birds or nodding donkeys. To my eyes, they looked more like a herd of dinosaurs feeding on the crops of cabbage and soybeans growing at their feet. Though these Jurassic Park-like scenes along the highway were once common, oil pump jacks are mostly extinct in the Midwest today, the victims of more efficient oil-gathering technologies. As we crossed the northern borders of Arkansas or Tennessee, we'd all tried to be the first one to spot one of the sure signs that we'd finally arrived in the American South. A field of cotton, perhaps, or a sharecropper's shack set back far from the road, its corrugated tin roof clinging to a collapsing frame. There wasn't anything particularly noteworthy about spotting a crumbling hovel with a washing machine rusting away on its front porch, I suppose, but I remember that such sights had a visceral impact on us. They marked our passage from a land that felt familiar and comfortable to a place that seemed foreign and strange. We were leaving behind a world where we and everyone we knew lived in roomy and well-built suburban homes in neighborhoods with wide green lawns and friendly neighbors. A place where dads went off to work in concrete and glass office buildings, and moms went shopping at palatial malls and sprawling supermarkets, while kids spent sunny Saturday afternoons playing kickball in the backyard or blasting alien invaders on video games in their basements. On seeing that first tiny ramshackle hut, we knew we'd entered a land where at least some people lived in homes with roofs that probably didn't keep the rain out. A place where entire families worked the surrounding fields to scratch out a living. And kids the same ages as us may not have even had the chance to attend school or watch TV because their families lacked the necessary income. What made observing these scenes from our car all the more unreal was knowing that we hadn't crossed a border into some neighboring, impoverished third-world country. We'd simply gotten in a car and driven a few hundred miles south in our own country. This was still America. It just wasn't the America we knew. To kids who grew up living a relatively sheltered life in the suburbs, the experience of seeing the harsh realities of lives so different than ours was striking. On our family road trips, we were traveling to new places indeed. Chapter 7. Eating Up the Miles. Dining While Driving. My father was one of those people born with no stop gene. He always had to be on the go, always had to be doing something. Even if he was sitting still, his mind was always racing, thinking about the next item on his to-do list, his next sales call, his next round of golf, his next rotary meeting, his next whatever. In short, my dad's disposition made him ill-suited for 15 to 20-hour road trips. The advent of the 55-mile-per-hour national maximum speed limit only exacerbated his restlessness. But what really aggravated him was having to make stops he judged unnecessary, which is to say any stop at all. If my dad had his way, we wouldn't have ever stopped. Not for meals, not to refill our gas tank, not even for potty breaks. And he wasn't alone in this thinking. A friend of mine told me that his father became so fed up making constant potty stops for the 8 kids in his family that he rigged up a toilet in the back of their family van. The facilities consisted of a funnel with a hose fed into a plastic milk jug. Fortunately, our dads weren't well acquainted. My dad also couldn't do much about our need to occasionally refuel, at least beyond stretching every tank full of gas to its gauge-defying limit. But he could control how often we stopped for meals. His main strategy was to forget meals altogether. As lunchtime approached after a long morning's drive, he'd click off the radio and announce, "Why don't we all take a break for a while? Maybe you kids can get a little extra sleep. You'll want to be rested for the beach tomorrow." We'd settle into our corners to read magazines, click away on our electronic games, or just doze off, only to awaken hours later with rumbling stomachs. Finally, one of us would say, "Dad, I'm hungry. When are we stopping to eat?" "Oh, look at that," he'd respond, playing dumb. "Did we miss lunch? Well, no point stopping now. We just ruin our appetites for dinner." Then he'd ease into the passing lane, just in case any exits appeared. As dinner time neared, our only hope was that Mom would join our protests and make him stop. Unfortunately, she was often exhausted from looking after four kids, and would often sleep right through our meal negotiations with Dad, so we'd simply cruise along until we reached our hotel for the night. By that time, most of the restaurants in the vicinity would be closed for the evening, and we had no other option but to grab snacks from the vending machines and hit the pool. This, of course, was just fine with Dad. The way he saw it, the sooner we turned in for the night, the sooner we could skip breakfast the next morning and get back on the road. My family saved a lot of money on meals while traveling. By the time I was 9, I'd traveled with my father long enough to know if I was going to stave off starvation during long days on the road, I had to rely on myself. So I began to pack my own provisions. A few days before we'd leave, I'd make my way to the village of Elm Grove, our local commercial hub atop my 5-speed Schwinn Orange Crate. The Orange Crate was a bike of almost indescribable beauty. It was one of Schwinn's Stingray bicycles, a line of bikes designed to resemble the top fuel dragsters popular in the 1970s. The Orange Crate came complete with raised handlebars, functional rear shocks, a banana seat with racing stripes, and a sweet 5-speed stick shift mounted on the top bar. The proud owners of these magnificent machines were the envy of every other kid in Kingdom. Once in town, I'd head straight to Phillips Pharmacy, one of the last of the classic pharmacies, the kind with a stainless steel lunch counter and waitresses wearing cat-eye frame eyeglasses and hairnets, who would mix cherry cokes by hand. Phillips Pharmacy boasted the best candy counter in the area, at least within Orange Crate riding distance, and it was there that I stocked up on all the supplies I'd need for a week on the road. I'd begin by grabbing a few proven staples, selections I could count on to fill me up between meals. These included a 1-pound bag of Twizzlers licorice, 3 Musketeers bars, Milky Ways, and perhaps a Reggie bar. This last choice was a gooey lump of caramel, nuts, and chocolate named for New York Yankee and World Series hero Reggie Jackson. As a loyal Milwaukee Brewers fan in an era when the Yankees were a perennial roadblock to my team's path to a league pennant, I detested Jackson as a player, but I couldn't deny his abilities as a confectioner. The Reggie bar was unquestionably tasty, even if it was a blatant ripoff of the Baby Ruth. I also reserved a portion of my budget for bubblegum, mainly because of its favorable flavor-to-mile ratio. This was no small consideration when I was about to embark on a 2,000-mile road trip. While a typical candy bar provided a few moments of tasty indulgence, a pack of bubblegum offered hours of satisfying chewing. I was also certain that one day my considerable bubble-blowing skills would earn inclusion in the Guinness Book of World Records. During my younger years, my preferred brand was Rainblow, which was really just a pack of oversized gumballs coated in bright colors with fruity flavors to match. Rainblow's 2 primary rivals for my allowance money, Double Bubble and Bazooka, were nearly impossible to chew just out of the wrapper. Both required concentrated effort to gradually grind into a pliable glop. But the problem with all 3 choices was that none seemed capable of producing a bubble larger than the size of an orange. That all changed in 1975, when Lifesavers introduced Bubble Yum, The first soft bubble gum. Unlike Rainblow's hollow gumballs, Bubble Yum came in thick, individually wrapped blocks that felt heavy and substantial. And unlike Double Bubble and Bazooka, Bubble Yum had a pleasant, spongy texture that was pliable and easy to chew right out of the wrapper. Bubble Yum's texture was so different from other brands that it sparked a pernicious rumor. According to some, the reason for the gum's pliability was a secret ingredient. Spider eggs. The rumor became so potentially damaging to sales that Lifesaver was compelled to place a full-page ad in the New York Times and other publications to deny its veracity. Most important, a single piece of bubble yum, skillfully blown, produced a bubble nearly the size of one's head. Bubble yum's key asset, its stickiness, also became its chief liability once the joy of blowing an enormous bubble had burst. It was nearly impossible to remove the tacky aftermath of a large bubble yum bubble explosion from one's face and hair. In an attempt to exploit that disadvantage, rival gum manufacturer William Wrigley Jr. Company introduced a similar but less sticky brand of bubble gum, Hubba Bubba, in 1979. American Chicle launched another competitor, Bubblicious, in the late 1970s. But I remained a bubble yum loyalist throughout my youth. With two pieces, one could blow a bubble the size of a watermelon. With an entire pack, who knew what was possible? A bubble the size of the Hindenburg? I became an instant bubble yum convert. Once I had the basics covered in stocking up on pre-trip supplies, I indulged in a few more exotic choices. Candies of the most resplendent cheapness and novelty. Razzles were a favorite because their gimmick appealed to my sense of value. I mean, how could one top a confection that was first a candy, then a gum? I also always picked up a box of Lemonheads because their sour finish provided a nice palate cleanser. Ever the little ham, I'd also throw in some wax lips or wax mustaches that I could pull out to get a laugh out of my mom. The downside to buying wax candy was that after playing my little joke, I was left with candy that tasted like, well, wax. As an alternative paraffin-based pleasure, I might include a bag of wax bottles. These were pinky-sized vials of wax, shaped like tiny Coke bottles filled with colorful syrupy goo flavored like popular brands of soda. In reality, they all just tasted like Kool-Aid that had been left out in the sun too long. Wax bottles didn't remain in my routine long. During one trip, my brother Bruce shifted himself onto my candy sack while sleeping and smushed the goo of a half dozen or so wax candy bottles onto the velour upholstery. After returning home, my dad made me spend hours scrubbing the stain out with soapy water. I never bought wax bottles again. Nearly everyone smoked in the 70s, and I was no exception, even if my smokes were of the confectionery kind. To my mind, the only proper way to conclude a sugary snack was with, well, more sugar. My indulgence of choice? Candy cigarettes, which were white sticks of chalky candy with one end dipped in bright red coloring to simulate a lit ember. These sugary totems of adulthood are still sold today, mostly online, despite laws banning them in many communities. Candy cigarettes were sold in packs of 10, in boxes resembling those of their tobacco cousins, in boxes resembling popular cigarette brands, but with fictitious names like King's, Target, and Stallion. In the 1950s, actual cigarette brand names were used, Salem, Pall Mall, Winston, and others. The only discernible difference in the packaging of the two products was the addition of the word candy next to cigarettes in tiny type beneath the logos. Apparently, tobacco companies were willing to overlook a little trademark infringement if candy cigarettes helped them recruit a new generation of customers. Candy cigarettes were nearly as addictive as real ones. They had a smooth flavor, like a wintergreen lozenge, and their sweet taste, along with a telltale white powder mark, clung to your lips long after taking a drag. Candy cigarettes offered another pleasure, too, watching adults in passing cars do double takes after glimpsing a 9-year-old puffing away on what appeared to be an unfiltered Camel. Hey, they were long car rides. Sometimes you had to invent your own fun. Finally, No trip to the candy counter in the late 1970s would have been complete without picking up at least a few foil envelopes of Pop Rocks. Introduced midway through the decade, Pop Rocks were an instant hit because of the way they literally exploded with flavor, popping and sizzling like tiny firecrackers on your tongue. Pop Rocks were just small chips of hard candy that had been carbonated and cooled to trap tiny bubbles of gas. When exposed to liquid, saliva for instance, the candy dissolved and the bubbles burst apart, causing a startling tingling sensation in your mouth. The candy's popular pop went from mildly disconcerting to downright alarming because of a nasty rumor, similar to the one attached to Bubble Yum. Talk began to circulate that the child actor who portrayed the character Mikey in a popular TV ad campaign for Life cereal had died after washing down a pack of Pop Rocks with a bottle of Coke. Supposedly, the combustible combination caused his stomach to explode. The story was hokum, but the Food and Drug Administration received so many calls from concerned parents that it was forced to set up a special hotline. And General Foods, the maker of Pop Rocks, launched a costly PR campaign to reassure the public about the product's safety. For my buddies and me, the danger only made Pop Rocks that much cooler. I made sure to pick up a few packs on every trip to the candy counter. Once I had made my selections, I would bike home and hide my candy on the highest shelf in my closet. It would take all my willpower to resist dipping into my stash until the moment of our departure. Not all kids had to resort to such drastic measures to stave off starvation on road trips. Though I have little knowledge of such things from personal experience, I'm told some families once even stopped for minutes, maybe an hour, to enjoy freshly cooked meals, served on actual plates with silverware, while out on the highways. In fact, one man built an empire preparing such meals for hungry travelers. His name was Howard Deering Johnson. Johnson inherited his entrepreneurial spirit from his father, who owned a Boston cigar store and export business in the early 1920s. Unfortunately for Johnson, he also inherited the equivalent of more than $100,000 in debt when his father died, and left him the foundering business. Quickly concluding that the cigar business might not be the best for striking it rich, Johnson decided to try his hand at another, buying a small drugstore and soda fountain in the Wollaston neighborhood of Quincy, Massachusetts in 1925. Business was brisk at the soda fountain, but competition was fierce. To help his business stand out, Johnson decided he needed to offer truly outstanding ice cream, like the kind made by a local pushcart vendor, an elderly German immigrant. Learning the man was contemplating retirement, Johnson paid the handsome sum of $300 for the vendor's recipe. The secret, Johnson learned, was doubling the typical amount of butterfat and using only natural ingredients. But for Johnson, even that wasn't enough. He locked himself away in his basement and used a hand-cranked ice cream maker to create and perfect 28 different flavors, a number Johnson believed covered every flavor in the world. The flavors included coconut, macaroon, fruit salad, and frozen pudding. Before long, customers were lining up for Johnson's tantalizing array of frozen treats. He quickly opened another stand at a local beach. It served as many as 14,000 cones in a single day. Leveraging the popularity of his ice cream, Johnson began serving freshly grilled meals as well, and soon opened a full-blown restaurant. Besides hamburgers, frankfurts, as Howard Johnson called his hot dogs, chicken pot pies, and other staples, the menu also included another New England favorite, fried clams. Unlike other restaurants which served whole clams, Howard Johnson's prepared and fried only the meaty foot of each clam, calling them clam strips. The item became Howard Johnson's signature dish. Still, Howard Johnson's might have remained a local favorite were it not for open discussion of adultery and abortion. It was those topics, among others, that spurred Boston's mayor to ban a planned production of Eugene O'Neill's play, Strange Interlude. The play moved to nearby Quincy, near the Howard Johnson's restaurant. The 5-hour performance included a break for dinner. affording thousands of wealthy and influential Bostonians the opportunity to discover the culinary delights awaiting them just down the road. Word of Howard Johnson's spread quickly. However, just as Johnson was hoping to take advantage of his growing fame by opening another location, the stock market crash of 1929 intervened. Unable to find financing, Johnson hit on the idea of leasing his restaurant's increasingly famous name and recipes to the owner of an existing restaurant. This location, on the tourist mecca of Cape Cod, also proved fabulously successful. Soon, other restaurant owners were clamoring to borrow the Howard Johnson's name and purchase his food. Howard Johnson had invented franchising. It wasn't long before Johnson purchased the exclusive rights to build restaurants in service plazas along the new Pennsylvania Turnpike, Ohio Turnpike, and New Jersey Turnpike. Striving to appeal to traveling families, Johnson designed the exteriors of his restaurants to resemble inviting colonial-style homes. The buildings were sided in white clapboard, with dormers and multi-paned windows, around a central cupola with a clock. Atop the cupola was a weather vane designed by artist John Alcott, featuring Simple Simon and the Pieman from the famous nursery rhyme. And to ensure motorists noticed and instantly recognized his restaurants, Howard Johnson had every one of his shingled roofs painted a vibrant shade of orange. Road trippers saw the restaurants all right. They also stopped in droves. By 1940, more than 100 Howard Johnsons lined the turnpikes along the East Coast all the way to Florida. World War II hit the chain hard, as it did most other businesses. But afterward, Howard Johnsons returned better and brighter than ever before, with a new design that replaced each building's staid dormers and clapboard siding with stucco walls and huge floor-to-ceiling plate glass windows in the counter areas. The colonial-style cupolas transformed into teal, space-age pyramids perched on low, wide roofs of sleek orange porcelain. But the Simple Simon weather vanes remained, as did the chain's appeal to travelers. By 1954, Howard Johnson's had rebounded from near extinction, with 400 restaurants along America's highways. Still, Johnson wanted more. Having seen independent motel operators build thriving businesses by locating near his popular restaurants, Johnson decided to get into lodging as well. Although the new interstates prohibited service plazas, Johnson aggressively purchased property near the end of exit ramps to build combined restaurant and lodging operations. As travel along the interstates exploded, so did Howard Johnson's. In 1965, Howard Johnson's sales exceeded those of McDonald's, Burger King, and Kentucky Fried Chicken combined. By the late 1970s, Howard Johnson's, now run by Johnson's son, Howard B. Johnson, controlled more than 1,000 restaurants under several names, and 500 motor lodges, making it the largest hospitality chain in the world. It didn't last. Facing the same competition and changing tastes that had doomed Stuckey's, Howard Johnson's lost its bright orange luster. Sold to a British company in 1980, Howard Johnson's restaurants were separated from the motor lodges and resold to Marriott, which rebranded most locations under new concepts. While Howard Johnson's motor lodges continue today as Wyndham Worldwide Properties, just one Howard Johnson's restaurant remains open, in Lake George, New York. Aside from its fame as the last remaining Howard Johnson's restaurant, the operation is also significant for giving one of America's most famous chefs her start. Rachel Ray worked there as a teenager. But for several generations of families, especially those who traveled America's East Coast highways, Howard Johnson's offered a comforting taste of home, along with 28 flavors of ice cream. If you want to start a food fight, there's no better way than to declare where to find the world's best barbecue, or proclaim who invented the first drive-through restaurant. In his book, The American Drive-In, History and Folklore of the Drive-In Restaurant and American Car Culture, Michael Carl Witzel makes a strong argument that credit for both should go to Texas entrepreneur Jesse G. Kirby and his chain of roadside pig stands, the first of which opened along the Dallas-Fort Worth Highway in 1921. Declaring, People in their cars are so lazy that they don't want to get out of them to eat. Kirby's brainstorm was to employ a fleet-footed staff of order takers. The car hops, so named because the tip-motivated servers would sprint out to hop up on an approaching automobile's running board, would take food orders right through the customer's car window, then hustle back with the chain's signature barbecue pork, pig sandwiches, and other food items moments later. Billed as America's Motor Lunch, the new system launched a craze. Technically, Kirby's idea of using car hops qualified his pig stand only as America's first drive-in restaurant. The first drive-through would come later, and once again Kirby's pig stand would be the originator. In 1931, it occurred to the owner of Pig Stand No. 21 in California that managing an unreliable group of young car hops required altogether too much energy. So he simply sawed a window into the wall beside his grill, allowing customers to drive up alongside the building, place their own orders, and collect their food directly from the cooks who prepared it. It was a classic example of eliminating the middleman. And so ends the debate about who invented the drive-through window, right? Well, don't go pulling off just yet. Other sources claim the idea was conceived by a young ginger-haired entrepreneur named Sheldon Red Cheney. Fresh out of business school, Cheney recognized the potential of the burgeoning travel craze in 1947. Scraping together some cash, Red and his bride, Julia, purchased a small gas station along Route 66 in Springfield, Missouri. After spending 16 hours a day pumping gas and observing customers, Red concluded two things. One, he didn't want to spend the rest of his life pumping gas. And two, people hate getting out of their cars. The Cheneys decided to get out of the business of fueling cars and into the business of feeding motorists. For menu inspiration, they needed only to catch sight of a nearby pasture of suddenly very nervous cattle. Redecorating their station on a shoestring, Red and Julia painted white clouds on the ceiling with blue skies and green pastures on the walls to resemble a picnic scene. They covered the dining room's table in red checkered tablecloths and topped each with a button spigot Coleman cooler and stack of paper cups so diners could dispense their own water. But the couple's most radical idea was adding a small window in the building's west wall, allowing drivers to pull up and order food right from their cars. Not everything went as planned. In his haste to convert the gas station into a restaurant, Red neglected to take a few simple measurements before ordering his new roadside sign. The design he selected was in the shape of a tall cross, with the word giant intersecting the word hamburger, which ran vertically down the post at the letter A. It was only when the delivery crew attempted to hoist the sign into place that Red realized his mistake. The towering sign was too tall to fit beneath a run of utility cables draped overhead. His options limited, Red picked up a saw and made a quick edit. And so Red's Giant Hamburger became the eminently more memorable Red's Giant Hamburg. The name piqued customers' curiosity, but it was the drive-through window that prompted cars to line up around the building. Whenever the line became too long, Red would bolt out the side door, pen and pad in hand, and scurry to each car's window to take orders before drivers pulled away. Meanwhile, Julia remained at the grill, flipping burgers and dispensing bags of food. Eventually, Red installed an intercom system so drivers could dictate orders before advancing to the window to collect their food. Voila! Red's Giant Hamburg became the first modern fast food drive-through restaurant. If you ignore the accounts of dozens of other journalists, authors, corporate PR departments, and Wikipedia citations. The catalog of those assigning, or claiming, credit for inventing the drive-through is longer than the list on McDonald's dollar menu board. Depending on whom you choose to believe, Harry and Esther Snyder created the drive-through, complete with a two-way speaker for ordering when they built the first In-N-Out burger in 1948. Or Fred Engel should get the credit because he pioneered drive-in service at his Made Right restaurants in 1927, 6 years after Kirby's Pig Stands. Jack in the Box claims to be the first fast food chain designed specifically for drive-through service, placing two-way speakers inside its friendly and colorful, or for you colorophobes, horrifying and menacing, clown heads, as early as 1951. Wendy's Hamburgers also claims credit for developing the first modern-day drive-thru window in 1971, though on what basis it's not clear. About the only thing most credible sources agree on is that none of these restaurants can take credit for inventing the drive-up window. Instead, the idea seems to have originated with an institution not typically associated with daring innovations, a bank. In 1928, Rufus Crosby Kemper, the ambitious young president of City Center Bank in Kansas City, Missouri, watched a routine repeat itself day after day. Just as his manager approached the bank's front doors to lock up at the close of business each day, the man would be nearly trampled by a stampede of local business owners and managers streaming in from nearby stores and diners to make their daily deposits. It gave Kemper an idea. As a convenience to his business customers, and to spare himself the headache of constantly replacing flattened bank managers, Kemper installed an after-hours collection window in the side of his bank. The fortified deposit window permitted customers to drop off each day's collections at their leisure on their drive home. Not long afterward, the Grand National Bank across the state in St. Louis one-upped Kemper's idea by adding a teller at their window. This allowed customers to conduct other types of transactions from their cars during normal banking hours. It was just a matter of time before restaurants and other businesses followed suit and added their own drive-through windows. To cater to a new generation of car-crazy consumers, America quickly became a drive-in nation. In addition to drive-in banks and drive-in restaurants, Americans could catch the latest shows at drive-in movie theaters, pick up food at drive-through grocery markets, and, in many states, swing by for a six-pack at drive-through liquor stores. In 1961, in Garden Grove, California, Pastor Robert Schuller founded the nation's first drive-in church to keep the faithful rolling on the highway to heaven. I like to think that a few of Pastor Schuller's faithful flock completed their mortal journey years later in New Roads, Louisiana. It was here in 1977 that the Point Coupe Funeral Home introduced the nation's first drive-through funeral service. It was during this same period that In-N-Out Burger, Jack in the Box, and other chains began staking their claims as the originators of the drive-through window. But it wasn't until the 70s that drive-through restaurants really became a phenomenon. Before then, many folks who didn't live on the West Coast, my family included, had never even seen a drive-through restaurant. While Wendy's Hamburgers claim that it installed the first modern-day drive-through window may be dubious, there's little doubt the chain was responsible for helping grease the wheels, so to speak, for drive-through windows to spread across the country. After opening his first Wendy's restaurant in Columbus, Ohio, founder Dave Thomas insisted on adding a drive-through window at his second location in 1971, and in nearly every location thereafter. Dave Thomas never lost his enthusiasm for drive-thrus either. Long after his face became familiar to millions in countless Wendy's TV spots, Thomas would regularly visit restaurant franchises around the country. On occasion, he'd don the headset of the drive-thru worker and surprise customers by personally handing over their orders. As Wendy's restaurants quickly fanned out across the nation, so did the idea of drive-thru windows. Soon, hungry motorists across America were able to purchase their meals on wheels. It took McDonald's a bit longer to pull ahead to the drive-thru window. Though McDonald's restaurants had been around since the 1940s, the chain didn't introduce its first drive-thru window until 1975. Even then, it was a window added by a single franchisee to accommodate the unusual needs of his principal customers. The McDonald's store in Sierra Vista, Arizona, was located just down the road from the Fort Huachuca military base, making it a popular lunch stop for soldiers. Military rules at the time prohibited enlisted personnel from exiting civilian vehicles dressed in fatigues, even if only to step out and pick up a Big Mac. To accommodate the soldiers, the franchisee, bucking corporate policy, installed a drive-through window. Soon, the only ones dealing with issues of fatigue were the fry cooks scrambling to fill orders for hungry customers. With the drive-through window a proven winner at the Sierra Vista location, other franchisees began lobbying McDonald's headquarters for permission to add their own. For McDonald's, the revelation couldn't have come at a better time. The company was in the midst of a growth spurt, fed by families like mine in search of cheap, dependable, kid-friendly meals while on the go. In 1970, McDonald's reported 500